Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations, where our children can play in a world without war, where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation, where the rivers run clean through the forests of green, where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace on earth.
And welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, or you can friend this program on Facebook. Today's program includes Planting the Future. A Kenyan environmentalist and Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Wangari Maathai, founded a grassroots organization that empowers African women to improve their lives and conserve the environment through planting trees. She speaks about the global balance of human and natural resources and shares her thoughts on where God resides. Interviewed by Krista Tippett. And then after that, fourth graders read a credit card agreement. Reading the thing you've never read, your credit card agreement. Does it really have to be so long and complicated? The fourth graders read a credit card agreement and tell us what they think.
She is a biologist by training, with flashing black eyes and a presence that fills the room. Wangari Maathai received the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize. Sitting across from her, it is not hard to imagine that this woman stood up to a dictator and won, and that she's fought off encroaching desert by planting 30 million trees and counting. Wangari Maathai knows what many in the West have failed yet to grasp, that ecological crises are often the hidden root cause of war. She speaks from experience this hour about the link between trees and soil, human flourishing, and democracy. She even shares her thoughts on where God resides.
The church teaches you that God is omnipresent. Now, if he is omnipresent, he's in Rome, but he can also be in Kenya at the same time if he is omnipresent.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Krista Tippett. Today on Being, Planting the Future. Wangari Maathai was born in colonial Africa in 1940. She was the first woman in Central Africa to earn a PhD. In the mid-1970s, she started planting trees with rural Kenyan women after she became aware of the consequences of soil erosion and deforestation in their daily lives. She founded the Greenbelt Movement there to create designated areas of park, farm, and uncultivated land around communities. For a quarter century, she battled powerful economic forces and Kenya's tyrannical ruler, Daniel Arap Moi. She was beaten and imprisoned, but her movement has now spread to over 600 communities in Kenya and into over 30 countries. I spoke with Wangari Maathai in 2006, and I learned that there is a powerful faith behind her passion, a fusion of Christianity, real-world encounters with good and evil, and the ancestral Kikuyu traditions of Kenya's Central Highlands. Wangari Maathai grew up there, schooled by Catholic missionaries, and she's a practicing Catholic to this day. The Kikuyu culture worshipped under trees and honored Mount Kenya, Africa's second highest mountain, as the place where God lives. And when Wangari Maathai looks back on her childhood now, she realizes that Kikuyu culture had an intuitive sense of environmental balance based on both pragmatic and spiritual teachings.
And one of the things that I may have inherited without being conscious about it, because my people were already Christians by the time I was growing up, is the fact that my people were very close to nature. And I like to give a story, for example, that reflects that. That when I was a young child, I used to collect firewood for my mother. And I remember my mother telling me not to collect any firewood from this tree called a fig tree, the so-called strangular fig tree. And when I asked her why not, she told me that is a tree of God. Hmm. We don't cut it, we don't burn it, we don't use it. They live for as long as they can, and they fall on their own when they are too old. Now, I didn't think much about that until much, much later. Indeed, when I became environmentally conscious, I remembered that story. I also recognized that in the period of maybe between 1920s to 1960s, a lot of those fig trees had actually been cut because having become Christians, the missionaries were very eager to get rid of all these trees that reminded the natives of a god that they did not relate to, because they needed to relate to another god. And this new god was a god who was worshipped in a house called church. But the god they were relating to prior to that was a god that they worshipped under these trees, such as that fig tree. Not every one of them, but they definitely were among the sacred trees.
And what did your mother mean? What was it about the fig tree? Was there more explanation to that, about what it was about it that was holy or of God?
Well, the point I want to emphasize here is these trees, because they are so huge and because they were never cut, they actually provided stabilization of the land, because these are highlands. Hmm. They protected these people from landslides.
Physically, they protected people.
Yeah, physically, yeah, they protected people.
There's nothing
people.
Mystical about this.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. They physically protected the land from sliding because it's so steep. And because they have roots that go very deep, and as I say, because they are not cut, they last forever, they are able to go down into the underground rock. They are able to break the rock, and they are able to bring some of the subterranean water system up nearer to the surface. And so they were responsible for many of the streams that dotted the landscape. So in many ways, therefore, they were part of the water system in the area. Mm. And so they served a very important purpose. Of course, nobody quite recognized that until now. Maybe people are beginning to see, well, where are these trees? Because we do get a lot of landslides now, by the way.
So there's a really pragmatic component to that religious teaching.
Yes, and sometimes in religion, whether it is Christian, Buddhism, or Judaism, we have these teachings you read in the Bible. The Bible tells you to do this. It doesn't tell you why. But sometimes it's because there is some coded wisdom.
Human wisdom, really.
It's human wisdom that people have accumulated in the course of generations. And sometimes it becomes a ritual, sometimes it becomes a cultural practice, sometimes it's associated with the festival. But when you look into many of these activities that people did before they were influenced by a foreign culture, there was always a very good reason why they did it. It was very much part of their way of having learned how to live within the environment in which they found themselves.
Wangari Maathai often refers to the biblical Genesis creation story when she speaks about the morality of environmental care, and she urges people to find new meaning in that story. For example, God celebrates the goodness of every aspect of the creation, she points out, and God would surely not celebrate human decimation of soil, forests, and rivers. Wangari Maathai believes that the Christianity she knew as a child in colonial Africa singled out the part of the Genesis story where God instructs Adam and Eve to dominate the natural world and subdue it.
Perhaps in those days, and especially as missionaries and explorers and settlers moved into new grounds, perhaps it really did look to them like the resources were unlimited.
Right.
But in the past, therefore, I would say that the Christian faith, and I can only talk about the Christian faith because that's my heritage, mm-hmm. has not really played the role of a custodian, such as now you hear theologians emphasizing.
Right,
that
I think there's an awakening about that within
Absolutely.
Christianity.
Absolutely, I guess that's what we should call it, is mm-hmm. an awakening. Mm-hmm. It's a good awakening. I don't really think I remember very much of religious teaching of how to take care of the environment. I studied biology.
Yes.
So I think that it was more out of the science and the understanding of the ecological systems and the observations I made in my country, especially the damage that seemed to be happening between the time I left my country in 1960, came to the United States for 5.5 years, then went back. And in that period, my country had become independent. It had introduced new ways of commercial agriculture. It had introduced cash crops, and these were now growing in the areas where there used to be woodlots, rivers which used to be nice and clean were no longer clean. They were full of silt. So these observations for me aroused an interest that there must be something that is happening that is bad. But it wasn't the faith. And I wish it was, because it should have been. I should have been reading right. the book of Genesis a little more closely.
Right. So clearly there was a huge change in your country between those years that you left and came back. And when I think about those years, the early 60s in the United States, it was clearly a really dramatic period here as well. Not a very environmentally conscious period in this culture.
No.
Although the civil rights movement was going on then. Mm. How did that time in the States flow into the perspective you took back to Kenya?
Yeah. Now, I want to say that sometimes, you know, things happen around in your life and you're not consciously absorbing them and you're not consciously asking yourself, now, what am I learning out
right.
of all this? But indeed, what you are observing, what you are reading, what you are seeing influences you, sometimes in your subconscious. And I'm quite sure that the civil rights movement in the United States in the 60s greatly influenced my sense of justice, my sense of the need to respect human rights, my sense of respecting the rule of law, which later on became very useful when I accidentally, I would say, became an activist for human rights issues, for women rights issues. And there was no effort for me to do that. And I'm quite sure that if I had not come to America at that time, I would probably not have made human rights issues an issue. It would probably not have struck me
really?
That somebody else's rights were being violated. Yeah, sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, you are a product of the society in which you grow. And quite often, it takes a special kind of mind to break away from the norm, to know or to believe that what everybody is accepting as norm is not right, and to question it, and to almost have people say, what's wrong with you? Everybody else thinks this is all right. Why do you think it's wrong? And I think that it is sometimes because you have escaped that society and you have gone to another place and you have seen
your vision has changed.
Your vision has changed. Your perception has changed. Your consciousness has changed. And so you come and you tell people, now, how can you accept that? And they want to say, what?
Right. Because you suddenly see it.
Yeah, you mm-hmm. suddenly see it, and you see it so clearly, so you're passionate about it, and sometimes people really don't understand what burns you.
You know, it's so true. As I was reading about the work you're doing, I mean, a tree is a simple thing, right?
Right.
But when you talk about the observations you started to make
yeah.
In listening initially, it sounds like, in the 70s, to women in Africa, and you started to suddenly see this simple equation between trees and having to walk far for water and soil erosion and lack of work and lack of fodder for animals and malnutrition. And you kind of wonder how that simple equation had broken apart.
Yeah.
I suppose that's a very common human paradox.
Mm.
But
yeah, I think that is so true. One of the things that happens, and this happens to us, whether it is because we are going through a colonial experience like we were, or you're going through an industrial experience like many people would experience in a country like America and other industrialized countries, what happens is that you slowly moved from the world you knew and you move into another world. And most of the times you move into a world that you believe is better. That's why we are told this is development.
Right. Progress.
This is progress. Yeah. And we accept it. Mm. And it takes us some time to realize, wait a minute, maybe it was not all good progress. Some aspects of it is not quite all right. And you're beginning to see how things have become disconnected. And now the challenge is to see, how can you connect them again? How can you make people see the linkages?
Mm-hmm. That, in fact, are organic.
Yeah.
I'm Krista Tippett on Being, conversation about meaning, religion, ethics, and ideas. Today with Nobel Peace Prize laureate and environmental activist Wangari Maathai. Wangari Maathai founded the Greenbelt Movement in 1977, while she was the first woman department chair ever at the University of Nairobi. So how did you start planting trees?
Well, in the University of Nairobi, there were very few women. There were actually originally two of us and then three. And we were being very badly treated because the university had never dealt with women academic members of staff, so they didn't have terms of service. But one thing they knew is that we should not enjoy the same terms of service as men. But they didn't know how to draft our terms of service. But before they got there, we were complaining like mad that we should not be discriminated against. And as part of this campaign, I joined the National Council of Women to represent the Association of University Women. Now, you remember in 1975, the first women's United Nations Women's Conference was in Mexico. And I found myself in a forum where Kenyan women were discussing their agenda that we should take to Mexico. And I came in, I had my own agenda about the discrimination of women in University of Nairobi.
Yes.
But when I got there, then I listened to what the rural women were talking about. And it was the rural women's story that actually struck me. And I completely forgot my story because for me, by comparison, I was complaining about minutiae. By comparison to what these women were really asking for. They were asking for water. They were asking for food, nutritious food. They were asking for energy, which was mainly firewood. And they were saying they have no income. And when I listened to what they were saying, it so happened that many of these women also came from the highlands, in the same highlands where I grew up. And it struck me that in that period of less than 10 years, so much change had taken place in the environment, that water was no longer clean. Yet when I was a child, I would go to the river and I fetch water for my mother. We'd come home, we would drink it, we didn't even boil it. And there was no firewood, and as a child, I was collecting firewood for my mother in the woodlots. But all these woodlots had been cleared to make way for tea and coffee. And because of the new commercial agriculture and because of clearing the bushes, now there was massive soil erosion and leaching of agrochemicals into the water, so the water was no longer clean. And that's why in my acceptance speech, I talked about the fact that... For the Nobel Prize. You remember I mentioned that I was shocked by the fact that the stream where I used to play as a child with the tadpoles dried up.
Right.
And the fig tree that my mother had talked about had been cut to make way for tea. And so I told the women, now you know what I think? We should plant trees.
You started with 7 trees, is that right?
I planted 7 trees. 5 died, 2
in
survived.
In downtown Nairobi.
In downtown Nairobi. Uh-huh. And the 2 are still alive, which is fantastic. Mm. But the important thing for me was to see the linkage. And that's what I try to encourage people to do. If you're going to do anything for the environment, you have to see what has been disconnected.
It really strikes me that how important it was, that proximity that you had to that land, and also that you saw what a short period of time it had taken for such destruction to happen.
Yes.
But maybe that also empowered you to think that taking some simple steps could, as you say, you know, reconnect what had been disconnected.
Yes, because I immediately could see that if you planted trees, you'd protect the soil from soil erosion, you'd provide the firewood for the women. If they planted fruit trees, they can supplement their diets. The trees grow very fast, so they can easily sell these trees and make an income. So I quickly saw how the tree could solve the problem.
I mean, I think that part of your story is so important because when people are presented, I think especially with these great ecological disasters or impending disasters.
Yes.
It's the same thing with political problems. Mm. It seems so enormous
that
an individual person wonders what they could possibly do. But, I mean, your story is actually one of looking at what you knew, what you were close to, and seeing what had gone wrong and seeing in a very basic way what you could do to move it back.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I really think that that's part of what the Norwegian Nobel Committee saw was the simplicity, but also the complexity.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that here's something that is being done by individuals at the grassroots level, but it also gradually had the capacity to get to the decision makers and make the decision makers sit up, either to stop you or to control you because they felt like you were threatening them. And
that two trees that live can become 30 million trees, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, indeed, because of the mobilization. But I would say, since we are talking about the faith, that to a very large extent, if I had perhaps not gone to school in a Catholic school, in a school that was managed by sisters, by nuns, at a time when missionaries were really very serious about values, they were very concerned about values, and especially the value of service. I think I would probably have turned out to be a different kind of a person. Because for me, as I said, sometimes people don't have to tell you this is what you need to believe in, and this is the value you need to embrace. You just observe. And when people ask me, who are the people who inspired you? These are some of the people who actually inspired me, these nuns. That these, at the time, beautiful women, young women. And I remember thinking, now, why did they leave their country to come here? Mm. Why didn't they get married and have families? And, of course, the answer was because they wanted to serve Jesus. They even wore rings because they told us they were married spiritually to Jesus.
Right.
I really couldn't see what is the benefit. We are so used to doing things because we benefit. There is something. Mm-hmm. We always want to know, why are you doing that? Because there must be something you're going to get. When you look at nuns like that, what do they get out of that?
And isn't that an interesting way also to think about, you and I were talking earlier about how the Christian church in general, Christian theology, has really not paid attention to the environment.
Yeah.
In fact, has interpreted some of the stories and teachings that are in there in a way that's been destructive to the environment. And there's people are waking up to that.
Mm.
But that's an interesting way to think about how even traditions which have something to correct can look to other virtues, right? And besides just the teaching on the environment, this virtue of service that is there and that has been very strong.
Mm. And that virtue is really what we are calling upon to take care of the environment, because we are saying we want to protect the environment, not so that we can use it, not for our own purpose. We want to protect biodiversity, not so that we can use these forms of life, because some of them we don't even know they're there. But it is to say that you're not doing it because of something beneficial that you are going to get, something tangible. And that's a very important experience, especially today, because I find, even in my own country, I find that every time you want to tell people, do this, it is good to do it. People want to say, what do I get out of it? Now, of course, for the nuns, they will tell you, I'll go to heaven. Well, okay, fine.
But it's a real long-term goal.
It's a long-term goal. And we are still here on earth.
Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, hard-working man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave. He went to the preacher, he went to the sheriff, told them all the same. Sell all of your jewelry and give it to the poor. So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus come to town, the working folks around believed what he did say. The bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on the cross, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Now the working people followed him around, sang and shouted gay. But the cops and soldiers nailed him in the air, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Well, the people held their breath when they heard about his death. Everybody wondered why. It was the landlord and the soldiers that he hired to nail Jesus Christ in the sky. This song was made in New York City of rich man's and preachers and slaves. If Jesus was to preach like he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man and a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave.
And now for something completely different.